to the Liminalist Podcast Between. This is Jason Halsey coming to you not very live from horticulture.com this week, talking to Gib Strange. Sure, we could spend lots of time catching up on this and that, but rather than do that, I wanted to talk to you about the Joker film because we ended up seeing it. I didn't even know that it had come to my local cinema. Usually I pay attention what's on there, but I hadn't noticed, and Tuesday night is the cheap night, so that's the only night I would have gone to see it. But I wouldn't have known, but we had a customer who spent more money than any other customer in history. She spent $300, but that included three of my books and the Mayan artwork tapestry that Mitch Fraz did for me years ago, which was on the wall for $200. We never thought we would sell it.
So wow.
She bought that as well at a cut price. Anyway, she said she was going to see the Joker tonight. She said it two or three times until it finally got through to me that it was actually playing in town. And then I heard your feedback and I thought, okay, so that confirmed my feelings that it was not going to be that great. But actually, I thought it was outstanding. I was really impressed by it. We both were.
I had a feeling.
With of course qualifications and all the rest of it, but anyway, so that's probably better, probably make it more interesting to talk about if we've got a slight divergence of opinion. So what didn't you like about it?
Well, as I said in the email, I feel that I'm in awe of it as like a cultural artifact of 2019. And I don't have like a value judgment about it. Like I told you, it's sort of not a great film, but it's not a bad film. It's just sort of this fascinating phenomenon, right?
Well, sure, we can get to that, but let's start with the aesthetic. Because I always think that's the first important layer, the essential layer. I don't like those critics or those cultural analysis that bypass the aesthetic layer as if it was irrelevant. Right? Mm. So you had a spectrum there between bad and great, but those are two ends. So there's good in the middle. Right?
Yeah,
so I wouldn't say it was a great film. I'd say it was a good film, even a very good film, by the standards of 2019, which they're pretty low, right?
Right.
So where would you place it in that way? I mean, what was your experience watching it?
What was my experience watching it? I mean, the Joaquin Phoenix's performance is, you know, the amazing thing about the film. That's the thing that carries the film. And, you know, if you think it's a good movie, it's because it's a really good performance. And that was what I liked about it. Film, you know, his performance.
I mean, it created a framework I thought was substantial enough for that performance and that character portrait to carry the whole film, to carry the experience, I'd say. But with the proviso that it wasn't really a fully drawn character. So as two-dimensional as the antagonistic characters were, the main character wasn't really three-dimensional, certainly not four-dimensional, particularly not in the context of Travis Bickle or even Rupert Pupkin or the 70s cinema that it was referencing. But I thought that this was actually, I think it was very, very cunning. It was almost like it was designed, you know, scientifically, that movie, because the context that it created was, to me, what made it most intriguing was that it was the movie was a medium and the message. It was both about and it was demonstrating or being in itself the contrast between 70s realism and 2019 comic book hyperrealism fantasy. So it was a DC supervillain movie that was done like, in quotes, the 70s realist psychodrama of alienation. It was a homage to those films. And I thought it was pretty well balanced in between, more or less right in between the two. If you imagine splicing those two together in Seth Brundle's telepod, I think you'd get something more or less stylistically like that. Yeah. So it certainly failed in terms of, if you compare it to the great 70s movies. Obviously, it's shallow and two dimensional. But then if you compare it to Marvel or DC superhero movies, then it seems very
quite a lot of depth.
Yeah, depth and substance and nuance and all of that. And the thing about this is that this was reflecting the split in the character himself, because he's living in fantasy of being the hero, but actually his reality is he's this miserable sociopath. And to the point that, as in King of Comedy, that line gets blurred, and we don't know. By the end, we don't know if any of what we've seen is real.
Right.
So that's very clever. I mean, that, I don't know how much they worked it out, but I think if you want to work a real headfuck movie out, then I think they did a good job in that regard.
Yeah, because there's enough blank slate for you to have to fill in and project onto.
Well, like with the neighbor, the girlfriend that never was, black actress from Atlanta, don't know her name. I thought, my wife is more canny, she can always see the strings when we watch things, but I thought that the filmmakers were just getting it wrong when they gave him a girlfriend. Why are they doing this? This doesn't fit. It's not realistic. Didn't actually occur to me it was a fantasy. So they got me, you know?
Right.
Even with all of my supposedly sophisticated knowledge of movie tricks, I still fell for that, partly because, well, it was a DC comic book movie by this guy, this director of The Hangover and all the rest of it. So
I see. So your expectations.
Of expectation.
Right. That's interesting.
So then it pulled it outsmarted me by saying it was a fantasy.
It outsmarted you by playing dumb.
Yeah.
And so when you were watching it, was your experience of, like, the Thomas Wayne character, did you also have that feeling of, oh, they're getting it wrong? Like, why, you know, he punches him immediately upon first meeting, and he's just the most kind of two-dimensional kind of mean person.
Not exactly. I mean, no, I didn't have the conscious thought that they'd done that wrong, because that's more of an aesthetic thing. So there were plenty of scenes where I was like, well, that wasn't quite satisfying, but I was giving a lot, you know, I was willing to overlook a lot. So I was reasonably satisfied with that, because I saw that they were trying to do something in very short, in just a scene. Wasn't sure what they were trying to do. And they were trying to do an awful lot of things, because they included the origin of Batman in there, which is the most purely comic book conventional thing in the movie, right?
Right.
They're actually trying to appeal to the Batman fans by including that.
Are we talking about the end with the killing of the parents?
Yeah. That's the origin of Batman.
Right.
Prior to that, and one thing that certainly occurred to me was they've given Batman sociopathic parents, which is a new twist.
Right.
It's realistic again. If he was born of multimillionaire parents, then they probably were sociopathic elite.
Is Thomas Wayne, I know he's not really in the Christopher Nolan movies, but is he remembered as a
good guy?
Good guy, yeah.
Well, certainly in the comic books, because all you know is that little Bruce loved him, and he's basically, I mean, you don't. It's a bit like that movie I just watched last night. I just spoke about Tell Me Who I Am, which he, the two twins, and the one has amnesia, so the other tells him that about his childhood and that his mother is a good person, but it turns out his mother is a child abusing sociopath. So it's a bit like that, because he didn't remember, because we didn't know anything about Bruce Wayne's father, we just fill it in that his death was a tragedy, therefore he was a good father, because the only things you see are just, whatever, him taking Bruce to the movies or him with his
Sure.
wife, just little snippets, and we fill in the rest.
Sure.
So the assumption is that he's a good father because it was tragedy that he was lost. In the Joker movie, they make Thomas Wayne the main character because for whatever reason they want to make it pre-Batman, when Bruce Wayne is still a child. I'm not sure why they made that choice, but anyway, so then it has to center around Bruce Wayne, I mean Thomas Wayne, being this villainous character, which is central to this other, the theme of kill the rich, which is the thing that is seemingly playing into our present social climate. I couldn't quite work out why or how the director, whatever his name is,
Todd Phillips.
that's what I thought it was, Todd Phillips, had intended this as a poke in the eye to woke culture, how he had and why it was effective. I couldn't quite see what upset the woke people about it.
I don't know what, let's see, so that would be like, we'd have to get into like the various reactions to the film, right? Because are the woke people offended by the film?
Well, I mean, all I picked up was a video by Sarkhan of Azul, whatever his name is, talking about how all these liberal critics had slammed it because it
Right.
offended their social justice warrior ethic.
Huh.
And also the director saying that he couldn't do a comedy anymore without offending anyone, so he was just going to do something that would deliberately offend these people.
Right. There was that press, those quotes from his interview. And in the film itself, it seemed like his polemics were most visible in the scene where Phoenix is on the Murray show and he sort of lashes out about you get to decide what's funny and what's not funny. Like that was the moment where I felt most like Todd Phillips was using this as a voice for his
Right, but that was in the
frustration.
context of the alienated incel who's angry with the dominant culture represented by Murray and Thomas Wayne, which of course is congruent with the rich, with the wealthy, who the Joker has been responsible for creating this movement. Kill the rich, even though the Joker himself doesn't have a specific,
He's an accidental hero.
leader. And he doesn't have particular animosity for the rich per se. It's kind of for everyone. So I mean, I can see how Extinction Rebels or social justice warriors who feel that they want to create a movement to take out the rich, the 1%, if they do anymore, I don't know, would see that they were being demonized by this, the narrative in which the Joker is the accidental hero leader of the revolution.
So that would be the offensive part.
I don't know, I'm just guessing. Like, I thought it was going to be quite obvious. But I wonder now if maybe Todd Phillips just didn't, how, what would you call that? Not preempting exactly, but he tried to ensure that the movie did give offense by telegraphing his intention to give offense
In the press.
in the press. It'd be a bit ironic, wouldn't it? Because this woke culture supposedly, you can't do anything without offending them, but when it comes to nuance and whatnot, they probably need it being telegraphed. I don't know. I mean, because couldn't it as well have been seen as like, what's his name, Joker, for some reason he was called Arthur. I don't remember the character was always called Arthur in the comic books, but anyway, being a stand-in for Donald Trump and this populist movement.
Well, certainly. And then also when Thomas Wayne is on television and he calls these poor people clowns, I mean, that would be comparable to Hillary Clinton calling people deplorables, right? So there's that parallel too, that, an elite kind of looking down her nose at.
Contempt, yeah. Yeah, so it didn't seem that it had a very obvious ideological slant to me. But maybe that was the problem, actually. Maybe because it wasn't obviously, advocating the right things, it was presumed to be offensive.
I mean, I think on the right track there with, I think that the Joker in general, that character in all his incarnations, is this kind of trickster figure. And so it is that wrench in the system that you're talking about with Trump, And that I think that's what moviegoers project onto that little spirit of anarchy, But
Go ahead.
oh, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, well, I guess we would have to do a bit more research, wouldn't we, to know what people are. It's perhaps not that interesting. I mean, what woke culture is finding offensive isn't ipso facto that interesting anyway. But I was just curious in terms of what.
I mean, that it might be as simple as seeing a mass murderer portrayed with sympathy is just too much
Right.
to take on, especially if it's not in the sort of fun context of a superhero movie where we can suspend our,
Like Deadpool,
right?
who's killing loads of people, but
Right. But it's a comic book movie, so
it's fun, yeah.
yeah. I have a theory about, maybe you can toss this around. I have a theory about why there hasn't been violence associated with this film. And because, we kind of talked about, well, this is, I don't know any, I haven't read your from your book, but the idea of like the Joker as a kind of psyop, I don't know, signal or some kind of thing that's in the culture, because there was I kind of told you, like, this whole thing of having undercover policemen at the premiere. There was a uniformed policeman at the premiere, that at the showing that I went to. He was out in the hall, and it almost felt to me like, oh God, I'm blanking on his name right now. The guy who did the Tingler, what's his name?
Oh God, that was ages ago.
He produced Rosemary's
Castle,
Baby.
was it William
Yes,
Castle? Yeah.
William Castle, like a publicity gimmick that he would come up with, like, you may be the victim of a mass shooting at this screening, And so, like, there was this sort of added theatricality about the whole event, and but that didn't happen. There was no violence around it the way there was with the Christopher Nolan movie. Although that was, we could get into that too, because it's, they continued to sort of report that actually this guy in Aurora, he was not connected to the Joker, but those were the initial reports, and so this mythology grew up around it, but so they'll report that that's not true, but they'll also, by bringing it up again, it sort of reinforces it. But my feeling about why this film doesn't inspire violence is that the transformation that Arthur Fleck undergoes, I mean, what can you say about his final transformation except that, he doesn't come anywhere near being, you know, becoming the clown prince of crime. He's barely competent enough, you know, he wouldn't be able to pull off a robbery, much less fight Batman, this person, what does he do? He goes on TV and has a very awkward, cringy performance. It really reminded me of in the 80s when Crispin Glover went on David Letterman and kicked at his head. And, you know, like some hipsters will try and pretend that that was some brilliant piece of performance art. But if you watch it, it's very cringy and embarrassing. You know, it didn't go Crispin Glover's way. Same thing with Joaquin's appearance on Letterman, you know?
His stunt, supposedly his stunt, yeah, which obviously, you know, came to mind watching the film.
Yeah, there's no way that they didn't talk about those late night appearances, right? Like, and they did very accurately capture the kind of cringy, embarrassing, you know, what is it, when he finally gets on there in front of the cameras, he sort of becomes a little queenie. You know, the persona of the Joker that he's become, you know, what can you say about it? Well, he's a good slow motion dancer, and he kind of does this awkward television performance. But he's still just basically, he's a little more comfortable in his skin, but he's not a, you know, he's not a criminal mastermind. He doesn't have any of the smooth talk that Heath Ledger. He doesn't say the right thing at the right moments. He basically has one moment where he kind of tells it like it is with his, when he actually has a joke and then he kills him. Yeah. And in my theater, there was like a little bit of scattered applause at that moment, you know, because this is kind of what the moviegoer is waiting for the whole time. Like, when is this poor, pathetic loser going to become a smooth criminal, right? And I think that that lack of dissonance, if you're watching Heath Ledger and you're an Arthur Fleck, you know, there's like a cognitive dissonance about, I should be this, but I'm not. And so there's these frustrations that come out. But I feel that there wasn't any of that in this film. There's none of that dissonance.
None of the dissonance.
Yeah, or the frustrating kind of, you know, I want to be powerful and say the right things.
Oh, so it wasn't poking already sensitive egos and insecurity complexes. It was actually placating them in a way, thinking, well, I could do better than this guy.
Yeah, right.
And at the same time, it wasn't inviting people to identify with a murderer because he was so pathetic.
Right. There's very little that's glamorous about that character, except when he dances.
And at the very end, when he has this whole movement around him, which seems like it was a fantasy, despite the fact that that being the key moment for comic book fans, because that's the moment we see Bruce Wayne's parents getting killed. So what seems like a total fantasy for the protagonist of the movie coincides with, you know, the one scene that is taken out of the traditional comic book storyline.
Right.
Except for the clown mask, that's a new addition. So I think that's very significant. It's like it's pointing out very clearly that the whole superhero, you know, storyline, narratives are fantasy based and the reality is something else. So in the reality of the movie, if we remove all the elements that suggest a false narrator's fantasy, Popkin-esque fantasy life, he's just a very alienated and dysfunctional character who finally snaps and maybe kill somebody for real on live TV, but then ends up in a lunatic asylum. Although even there, it didn't quite, I mean, the supposedly the real scene at the end, which invokes Psycho, the end of Psycho, it was improbable, and it was done in a way that was Chaplin-esque, him running, you know, being chased by the orderlies. So that didn't seem very real.
It's pretty classic. So go on. Where you're saying if you take it straight as that's the narrative.
Oh, hadn't I finished that point? I thought I had, just that there's no reason to want to identify with that character. Because we don't know. I mean, the whole thing of mimesis, copycat killings and all that, it's very difficult to analyze because we don't know how many of the copycat crimes have themselves been staged in order to generate mimesis. People are more likely to imitate people who actually do things than they are characters on a movie screen, by definition. But if you put the two together, you've got a much more compelling thing, because you've got the movie narrative, which does stimulate our fantasy life and our unconscious, you know, associations, archetypal yearning and all that. And then you've got a real narrative, which is kind of sordid, and because it's real. But the two together, like, well, I saw that movie and I kind of wanted to go out and kill people, but of course I wouldn't. But then this guy actually did it. Fuck me, I need to up my game and not be such a pussy, right? You can see how if they're trying to generate mimesis, school shootings and whatnot, they need the combination of the fantasy movie narratives with real life thing. So then you've got Taxi Driver, followed by John Hinckley, followed by Bernard Goetz, which was clearly referenced, I just realized, in the Joker movie. It's an inversion because, well, kind of an inversion, because in the Bernard Goetz case, he shot three black guys on a subway train because they were bugging him. And he became a kind of quasi-hero. He got off anyway. And the Joker shoots three Wall Street white guys.
Right.
And he becomes a hero, a real hero for it. So there's an inversion there, but also a reference to, I mean, Bernard Goetz was never attributed with imitating Travis Bickle. There was no obvious way that he was imitating him, but it was pretty close match, really. Shooting a bunch of black guys on the New York subway and getting away with it. It's pretty damn close. Closer to the Hinckley killing, if it wasn't for the fact that Hinckley said, Taxi Driver made me do it, right? Because it's, yeah, anyway. it's both sides. It's Kasinka. Bickle tries to shoot a political candidate, and then he shoots a bunch of black guys and white guys. So the Getz and the Hinckley together, they're like social events that seemed to echo and were inspired by Taxi Driver, but they took a long time. So with the Joker, we got this idea, this movie's going to provoke people to crime right on the day it opens, because the previous Batman movies have done that, I guess, and because of the content in the movie, that it's about killing the rich and about the, this is a very topical idea, actually. I mean, topical in a personal sense, the correlation like Cusans took to me about between revolution and well, violence, that's kind of obvious, but subvert transgression, acts of transgression as a means to bring about revolution. With the Georges Bataille thing.
I was just thinking, yeah, Georges Bataille.
Right. And the avant-garde thing and the surrealists about how the most pure surrealist act is shooting into a crowd with a pistol
Yeah,
at belly level.
that's Andre Breton's.
That's André Breton, yeah. And for years I thought that was just figurative, and now I'm only just now realizing he wasn't talking figuratively at all. He's talking literally. And now we live in a culture where this is becoming more and more plausible that people would go and shoot random strangers as a revolutionary act or as an aesthetic, as an avant-garde kind of statement.
Gesture, right.
And so the Joker's that the character of the Joker is very much like that. He's like a pop cultural version of the surrealist, Dada, avant-garde, criminal psychopath as artist and vice versa, a revolutionary artist. So nihilism, proactive nihilism, which is transgression, will transgression. You become a god of your own reality because there is no god. It's identity politics, isn't it? And so then you become a mass murderer. That's the logical, just as for the surrealists, their endeavor to transform ordinary reality into dream reality, into a certain that was no difference, had to end with the idea of murder, because they say, oh, we can fly, we can kill you people. Well, they can't fly. Doesn't matter how much you say that this reality is a dream, you can't fly unless you're Castaneda. So then that just leaves killing people. Like, if you want to do something that seems impossible but isn't, doesn't defy the law of physics, you end up with just transgression. Right? Because what else is left, really? I mean, you become president or a movie star, and that's kind of equally impossible. It doesn't defy the law of physics, but you can't do that. Like Pupkin found out, you can't just will yourself to become a celebrity unless you kill somebody in such a way. So then killing somebody is kind of the extra bonus that if you do it right, you might even become a celebrity as well. But even if you don't, you've still defied social reality.
That's very like Leopold and Loeb and Ian Brady had that very, that was part of their whole intention. Transcending.
Transcending, the laws of society is the closest, you get to transcending the laws of nature. Actually, it's embracing the laws of nature is one of the ways they see it. That was Mickey Steel, right? The predator in the jungle.
But none of those people, the tie-in with fame or wanting to be famous that you get with Rupert Pupkin, you that's not part of any of the real killer's agenda, right?
To be famous. Well, it is part of, it is a trope for the serial killers, which goes back to at least to the Zodiac killers. I assume there was more than one. But
Quite a lot of interaction with the press.
that whole baiting the press, baiting the police, giving clues and
And of course, it's a big part of what's going on with the mass shooting people because they're all trying to outdo the last mass shooter, get their kill count higher and get a
do we
bigger.
know this for sure, or is that
Yeah, of course, that's all
speculation?
right. Well,
I mean, have any of them said that? Like, I wanted to beat so and so's record because.
Well, there's quite a lot of like, reverence for, like the ones who came before, like the Columbine shooters are sort of regarded as heroes, and then, these guys.
Well, I mean, it stands to reason, of course. I mean, if you're trying to break taboos, you've got to.
Next level
Yeah,
it.
the bar keeps going up in that regard.
Right.
Not that the taboos disappear just because people break them, but it's obviously less shocking if you shoot one person at school when yesterday, 20 were shot. Gets lost, and certainly if you want media coverage. Nowadays, yeah, it's not enough just to shoot a couple of kids at school to even get covered by the media, I don't think, is it? Because it's happening every day, at least so the media would have us believe.
Right. And some people write manifestos and some don't, That's part of it too.
Well, that he's an interesting case, Kaczynski, because he supposedly he only got caught because he got the press to publish his manifesto, and then his brother's wife recognized the writing and.
Yeah, it all came full circle, and beyond that, the only he sort of delegitimized his manifesto by
By getting caught, yeah.
no, well,
Wait.
nobody can read it without thinking, well, this is the thoughts of a crazy
Of a crazy
person.
person, yeah. So that's right. And he only got it published because he'd already committed the bombing, right?
Right.
Otherwise, yeah, the press would never have published it. So,
The message got out, but the message is pretty tainted,
you say that, and I heard in that documentary, I think that you recommended, one of the people was saying, we can't take this seriously because the guy's a mass murderer. Well, I think you and I talked about this before. It's an interesting argument because it's close to what I argue about movies and culture, that we need to identify the sources and recognize that the material is going to be tainted. So if Woody Allen really did abuse Dylan when she was tiny, and if he's into that stuff, then his whole oeuvre becomes compromised. Everyone has to look at it with that eye, like how much is this his cover and his dissociative fantasy life and et cetera, et cetera. It definitely changes it, but it doesn't completely invalidate it, for one thing. And for another, with Kaczynski, I mean, it seems somewhat different. As in, if an entertainer is revealed as a sociopath and as a cultural hero, even like a role model like Woody Allen, then yeah, you've really got to say, well, wait a minute, the whole, the house of cards might be tumbling here.
Right.
But if a bomber commits murder and then releases a manifesto that attempts to justify the murder through cogent argumentation, not that I'm in Kaczynski's corner here, it might sound like it, but I haven't read the damn thing. But theoretically, obviously, he believes that there is an argument for terrorism. People do. The whole thing of non-violent protest, I think, was partly social engineered by people that my grandfather was involved in as a way to neutralize the threat of the revolting masses. If they're going to revolt, make sure they don't do any damage to property when they do it. And if we want violence so that we can bring down, the martial forces on them, we can always send in an agent provocateur, and we can create a violent resistance if we need one. But let's neutralize it overall so that we don't have violent movements that we haven't created. That seems like that would be sensible for social engineering, or as a social engineering strategy. So if peaceful protest was created by the ruling class as a way to neutralize the working classes and the revolutionaries, then that does leave a gap there for, okay, maybe there is a rationale for violent protest if you believe in trying to bring about social change at all. I don't, so I'm off the hook. I don't have to, be accused of justifying. I'm just saying, if you believe in social change, then I don't see how you can close the book on using violence. Anyway, and that's what Kaczynski was arguing.
Right.
So how does that invalidate it? It's just a moral.
Well,
It's ad hominem, isn't it? He's a murdering psychopath, therefore nothing he says has any value.
right. I mean, for you or I, I mean, I guess in some ways this could relate to the Todd Phillips thing in terms of like a certain woke culture's inability to entertain that kind of nuance, right?
Face reality was what I was going to say, but yeah,
Well,
that's another way of putting it. Yeah, to really think about things from different angles.
right.
And
Because, oh,
yeah,
go ahead.
well, I mean, I'm not, we're probably neither of us particularly well up on what SJWs are up to, and but I think the Extinction Rebellion, let's say, seems to me that these movements for social justice or social change, they seem to be disproportionately or improbably dependent on trying to persuade powerful institutions to listen. Right? So, if Extinction Rebellion are worried about the extinction of the human race or of other species because of the state of the world, stopping a few trains or flight shaming a few, frequent flyers, clearly it's just going to piss off the wrong people. If you're aiming it at the workers to inconvenience them, you're not going to bring about any kind of, that's not going to influence the institutions. But the point here is that nothing will. I mean, the tail doesn't wag the dog, so why would these, I don't want to keep using the term SJW because I think it's lazy, but why would activists, people who really want to bring about social change, where did they get this idea that you can somehow persuade or even pressure the institutions, the governments and the military, industrial and complexes, into changing policy?
To make that system work for
Yeah,
you.
to make it work, based on a moral argument, basically.
Sure. Well, that's where, the centrists and the moderates, that's the frustrating thing about that attitude. I just saw a clip of Noam Chomsky saying something about how the Weather Underground, that all that they did was piss off construction workers, that their aims didn't, completely unsuccessful. And that's what I mean about the Unabomber. For most people, it's like, his targets were people affiliated with universities. So that was the institution he was taking on. I mean, obviously the manifesto's, taking on enemies of environmentalism
And he
and
bombed the
in, industrial
FBI, didn't
society. What's that?
he? He bombed the FBI building, didn't he?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
So but the bigger target is industrial society, and I was just thinking, like, I've noticed that a lot of like Bond villains and villains in pop culture lately have been environmentalists. It's kind of a strange trend that's been developing.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
But where was I going with all that? Just that, so anybody, you got the manifesto out, but you've totally invalidated it to the straight, it's not like anybody's read the manifesto and was like, this guy's got a great point, and we should really be doing something about this.
Right. It might be inspiring other mad bombers, I
Radicals.
suppose, if there are any out there. I presume there are. But yeah, where were you getting to in terms of the futility of rhetorical revolt?
Well, I sort of lost wherever I was going with that, but it's like, you know, the accidental revolt that Arthur Fleck inspires, you know, in some ways reminded me of the Occupy movement, the Occupy Wall Street movement. It didn't have any clear goals or clear aims. It was just sort of this like epileptic reaction to, you know, mass inequality, right? And
yeah.
So it wasn't organized. It was, and there's a similar, there's a correlation to these mass shootings that keep happening, right? Because, you know, it's random chaos. It's not, it's maybe misdirected rage, right? But there's no target, there's no goal that's...
Right, and that's closer to a... And that definitely is where the Joker thing converges, with mass killings, etc., with activism. They converge in the Joker movie and the movement. And the school shootings and so on, that kind of undirected rage being directed, I guess, is a much more, you could even say honest, but it's much more obvious just expression of personal individual frustration and dissatisfaction. The activism seems to me that it's a less honest or less open, less conscious expression of the same, or at least it's going to converge with it at a certain point. It could start with just good intentions and naivete, couldn't it? As in, the world is obviously fucked. Some of the ways in which the world is fucked society are obvious also. And therefore addressing them seems obvious, and changing them would seem to be, if not easy, logical. So then the naive and the uninformed, politically or parapolitically, might get together with a movement or even try and start a movement which just tries to confront the powers that be with these facts, as if the powers that be were completely ignorant to them rather than simply totally indifferent.
Oh, yeah. Like, oh, you've opened my eyes.
Right. And then what the experience are they going to have? They're going to have the experience of being ignored, of being marginalized, of being perhaps demonized, of just being rejected. I mean, ignored is really right there in the first word, actually. But like a child's experience of trying to get the parent's attention. Parent isn't interested. You're just a child. Don't bother me. Right? It's a bad parent, bad government. Doesn't care what the people think or what they want because it has its own agendas. It's not assuming responsibility for raising its children or for helping its people to become autonomous, because it's not a democracy. It's not a participatory democracy. It's a pseudo-democracy.
Yeah, yeah, that's the premise. That's the facade, but actually...
the facade is a participatory democracy.
Right.
But, and I had this insight recently, we've been miseducated, misinformed, propagandized, etc., into a false kind of politicization, so that we now think that ideas and opinions have the power to change social policy. We think that because we think we're in a democracy, we think that it's people's desires, votes, that change policy. Now, of course, it isn't. It's something else. But because of that, we've given an excessive, a disproportionate amount of power to opinions, as if opinions equal policy or the power to dictate the policy. So you see how on the one end, that means that if I say even a fact about something like immigration or what have you, people assume that I'm supporting some policy or another, rather than simply stating a fact.
Right. So in other words, opinions become connected to a political...
Agenda,
yeah, automatically.
Or a desire for one, right? And not just opinions, even facts. Because if facts are the wrong kind of facts, if the facts about immigration destabilizes the society and increases racism, say, maybe they're not facts, but let's just say they are for the sake of argument, they're not allowed to be introduced by people who are pro-immigration ipso facto, regardless of any factual information, because they suggest a different policy to the one that they think that they can implement with their opinions or their facts, right? So this over exaggerated idea about how much opinions lead to policy change corresponds with, I think, or compensates for an almost complete absence of individuals' ability to participate in the policy making within their own lives, like as in their own local communities. People want to change the world by having the right opinions, but they've got no clue about how to change little things just in their own community or even in their own household by making, you know, well-informed decisions and acting in a way that is, you know, grounded and responsible and honest, right?
Well, there's quite a lot of ground there you just covered.
It's true. I did. I went on a spiel, but so it was all about the activism and why the activism is just going to lead to frustration and violence.
And isn't, I mean, when you were talking there, it occurred to me, like, you know, the internet of things is this. It's suggested somewhere in that narrative that you just presented that if I just tweet enough, you know, if I just put the right opinions out there enough, that's being part of the solution. Or and in a strange way, the internet does seem to represent, like I've thought, I feel like many people are starting to feel like, well, if democracy is the internet, you know, the chaos of the internet where everybody has their say, it doesn't look great, does it? You know?
Well, so the shadow of that is the populism, I think, as in Trump was the internet created president and all
right.
of these, this unknown majority, like it hadn't been acknowledged that there were that
right.
many people who were into Brexit or into Trump. So this is when democracy becomes slightly participatory because of the internet.
Yeah, right. That's true, right? So Twitter gives voice to this thing that would be a platform that he, I don't, you know, like after he won, it was sort of like he said, I couldn't have done it without Twitter. And I think that's probably true, you know?
Well, same with Brexit. I mean, if you saw it, I mean, okay, it's a movie, so obviously a big pinch of salt, but the HBO movie with Cumberbatch in it, Benedict, whatever his name is.
Does he play Julian Assange?
He does in another movie, doesn't he? But in this one, he plays whoever the guy was, the computer-savvy guy who managed to get Brexit through by using the internet in a way that other politicians
right.
were just ignorant
right
about, right, and tapping in to an untapped resource of votes.
See, if Ted Kaczynski had just mastered the internet instead of he could have effected real change. I meant that to be ironic. It wasn't.
Yes, I think you communicated the irony. I just didn't have a chuckle for you, sorry. I wasn't going to fake it. I could have done a Joaquin Phoenix laugh. but no, I mean, this is really, it's very topical because the activists, the social change warriors, etc., they want their opinions to matter. They want a real democracy. They believe in the democracy that we've been sold, number one, and then they want to use it because they believe in it to bring about a new world order that's morally, politically correct, right? That they believe we were on the verge of before things went horribly wrong, right? That everybody agreed, Starship Enterprise, we've now found the Prime Directive and everything's right, slavery's wrong, you know, misogyny is wrong, homophobia is wrong. There's this whole itinerary of rights and wrongs that seem like they'd been more or less established from the small to the great. Thereby, it was the end of history. It was the beginning of the utopian society where basically we all knew what the difference between right and wrong. There's been this belief, right? And that includes the belief in democracy, that if the people could only, you know, mobilize and bring about the world that we all know is the right kind of world, then we're home. And to the extent that that's been possible, populism has arisen and emerged. We have the very shadow of what that sensibility and that ideology represents. We have the demon Trump and the nightmare of Brexit, and I guess Arthur Fleck and the Joker. I don't know exactly how he fits into that, but I think there's something about that archetypal thing, like you said, the trickster figure of liminality, who represents the real face of order in chaos, or the real face of chaos, laughing at disorder. I don't know what it is, but it's like you get the leaders you deserve, you get the heroes the deserve you deserve kind of thing.
Or as the song that Trump played during his campaign, you can't always get what you wanted, get what you need.
Like the Joker movie, the thing about the Joker movie that's key, I think, is that it's the Joker movie. That means he's the hero of the movie, however you slice it. You don't have a movie with just the villain in it, because compared to who, right? And as you said, the other characters, the peripheral characters, were antagonists to the Joker. They weren't heroic, they were two-dimensionally villainous. Or shallow and corrupt, anyway. Even and his mother was certainly, she wasn't exactly demonized, but
There just wasn't a lot there, you know, there's
she said
not.
she abused him anyway, so it's bad enough.
But you find that out, and there's no sort of indication prior to that, you know, like you don't get a sense via their interaction.
Except that he's obviously psychically meshed with the Norman Bates star relationship.
Right. But go on there. So there's these, you know, you've got the hero, but you've got these kind of 2D villains.
Yeah. So and this thing about reading and writing about narratives, how narratives are much more powerful than rhetoric or political argument for transmitting values and influencing people's thoughts and behaviors. Seems like an obvious thing, right? But what this means is that fiction, generally speaking, is more powerful than non-fiction to influence us. So you can have philosophical or political arguments or Ted Kaczynski's manifesto, and it doesn't matter that we know that it's based on true principles, scientific or psychological or political or social, whatever. It's not going to influence us as deeply as a narrative, because in a narrative, we transport ourselves into it and we leave behind our origin, the world of our origin. So that means things that we know in our ordinary lives, we will consciously or unconsciously suspend in order to carry on immersing, being transported by the narrative.
Sure.
Because we're in it for our enjoyment. We suspend disbelief. So then, because we've left behind these things we know in this world to get transported into the narrative, we'll be easily persuaded by the reality of the narrative. Right? Because we don't have these things we know to refer to. We've actually voluntary amnesia. So then you get sucked into a narrative of the Joker. It doesn't really matter that he's a psychopath. He's our guide through that world. He's our only point of identity. Who else are you going to identify with in that movie?
Right.
To me, the most uplifting thing, or the most, not just uplifting, the most emotionally affecting thing about the movie was the ending, when he's triumphant. Like, I didn't feel a great deal of anguish for him. I didn't feel a great deal of sorrow. Didn't feel a great deal of fear of him being a psychopath. I didn't have very many strong emotional responses to that film, considering how disturbing the material, the content was. The strongest emotional response I had was at the end, when he's vindicated. He's vindicated by this movement.
Mm.
And I think that was probably intentional. And I think even the fact it coincided with the creation of the Batman,
mm-hmm.
very profound, because Batman and Joker, of course, is the shadow dyad.
Mm-hmm.
And traditionally, Batman's the hero, even though he's dark and sinister and ominous. And the Joker is the villain, even though he's bright and gaudy and happy and laughing and dancing. So it already inverts our, you know, primary social associations for good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the Joker movie, it's like it inverts them back again in some way. Well, at least potentially, because we're identified with the Joker. And we're even seeing that the Joker has created the Batman, and that's what we want.
Mm.
Right? So that's a good. Like, good doesn't come out of evil. Well, maybe it does, actually. But, I mean, that's a confusing thing to understand. Point is if the Joker having this apotheosis gives rise to the Batman, whatever that means in the future, that's what we want. We want the Batman to be created.
So but the sense would be that some kind of good is arising out of all of this. It's, you're right, it is all kind of, you can't actually say darkness, and you can't actually say that in that world that the Batman that comes, that is born of that situation, is going to be good, or, you know what I mean? Like,
it's pretty unlikely, doesn't it? Within the realism of the movie, this kid who watches his parents get slaughtered during this insane uprising, it's not likely to grow up to be, you know, a heroic paragon of virtue.
Right.
But anyway, I mean, traditionally, archetypally, he is. But the Batman is also, I mean, in the later reinvented Batman, he's more and more of this fascist kind of character, even in the Nolan movies, who's imposing this vigilante order. And this is happening in the real world too. He's the unofficial arm of justice of the fascist state, because the fascist state can't openly act in a vigilante fashion. It needs, and we've got the Antifas in Portland now, like they're supported by the mayor, and they're going around beating up people for having the wrong opinions, who've got nothing, no fascist qualities whatsoever, just reporters and things like that. And they're being supported by the mayor, and they're at this, and by the chief of police. Well, it's the same guy, I think. The mayor and the chief of police is the same guy in Portland. It's like they have the Antifa as their vigilante task force, and they're unaccountable, of course, because they're just, people.
So Batman's the sanctioned, he can do the things Commissioner Gordon wishes he could do.
Exactly. Yeah, he's unaccountable. So in that context, you do have that does reinforce the idea that the Joker actually is this agent of chaos, like Heath Ledger said in the other movie. He's ahead of the curve, who's a revolutionary force, because you don't have a revolution without chaos. And then Batman's just the old world trying to reassert its hegemony.
Oof, right. Right. Thinking about it, because I was thinking about this coming into this in the 70s, Rainer Fassbinder, he made a movie about terrorism, and that was kind of his thesis was, capitalism brings about terrorism to strengthen its hegemony.
Right. Oh yeah, well there you go then. So the thing that makes the Joker seem heroic is just that he's the other face of the villain, and ditto with Batman. I mean they're both manifestations of the collective unconscious, which is the deep state, the deep human state. One of the taboos that's consistent throughout human history, existence, is body mutilation, for obvious reasons. So we have a spectrum of body changes that we can make, and somewhere on the spectrum they start to become threatening, taboo, breaking, right? Like earrings are socially acceptable, even nose rings at this point, but having your lips split down the middle by a big animal bone or whatever wouldn't be, and so on, because that keeps moving. But because of this, apparently, when we're confronted with bodies that have been mutilated or altered in dramatic ways, it increases our desire to virtue signal. I mean, virtue signaling is a kind of modern term, but to stress our own virtuousness and to stress the need for virtue. I mean, it makes sense. If you feel you're in the presence of taboo, you want to counteract it by becoming more moral, right? So this is interesting in terms of the what are we going to call it? Did you know, by the way, that the T, no, the LGB have divorce themselves from LGBT at this point, or at least some of them.
Wait, is this official or was there a meeting? What happened?
Well, it is official in that there is now an LGB who have created their own thing in order not to have the T. They don't want to be associated with transgender.
And is it different than the TERFs?
Right. Well, the TERFs are trans-exclusionary radical feminists, and but that's a term of slander by trans activists against them. So they don't self-identify as TERFs; they just get called that
I
as an
got it.
attack on their position. But it's similar, as in feminists who don't want to be associated with trans, but F isn't part of LGBT. anyway. There isn't a feminist part of that. So there the parallel ends. But anyway, that was just a digression because I was going to say that if you think about in LGBT events, where there's a lot of SJWs, there's also a lot of T's, as in people who've changed their bodies in ways that are often quite dramatic. It's also true, I was watching this documentary on the Temple of Satan. There's an awful lot of, there's trans people in there, but there's also, obviously, as you can guess, people with, weird body mutilations going on. And they're all about virtue signaling, if you can believe this. The Temple of Satan are all about how good they are because they pick up garbage and they do social community service and very weird. But anyway, another digression within a digression. Point I was trying to get to was, if you imagine an LGBT community or meeting or whatever, you've got quite a few people with weird body stuff, and you've also got a whole bunch of other people who are constantly moralizing and virtue signaling. So you could say that they're constantly triggering each other, because on the one hand they're trying to be socially conscientious and inclusivist, all saying, politically correct, moral, basically. They're moralistic. On the other hand, it's all about freedom of expression and doing weird shit to your body. And that's a very basic taboo that's triggering people to feel threatened.
But are they actually acknowledging that threat, or are you just saying that on a primal level that people aren't,
Primal level, yeah,
they're not going to be talking about?
they wouldn't be able to consciously acknowledge it because it's great. It's all wonderful and great. Like, I mean, it's a bit weird because Hell's Angels used to, get loads of tattoos, and so there's all kinds of seedy criminal aspects of society that are into weird body mutilations. They're not that weird, actually, a lot of them. But anyway, but it's also part of the progressive young. Like, I imagine if you were to go on Extinction Rebellion, you'd see quite a lot of,
Piercings.
piercings and tattoos and obviously dyed hair and trans people and so on and so forth. So there's this internal tension anyway. Anyway, I thought we could bring it back to the Joker somehow, because his thing, I mean, it's very central to the origin of the Joker, is how does he mutilate himself? How does he become a freak that telegraphs his identity as the Joker, his uniqueness, right? What makes him a super villain? He's not just a psychopath. He's, as I said, he's a criminal mastermind. But central to that is that he's physically different.
Except in this story, like that, I mean, wasn't that the exciting thing about the premise? Like right from the trailer, it was what people were talking about is that traditionally the Joker has been dropped in toxic waste and is disfigured, or he has these scars on his face. But here, this person is suffering from the basic trauma of existing in society, which everyone seems to be able to relate to, right, at this point.
Right, and he has to transform himself. I mean, they bridged those things then with the Heath Ledger Joker, because it was inferred, although he did have different versions of the story each time, but it was inferred that his father or family
Something
member
happened.
was abusing him and just cut his face like that, which would be the Litvinov, or the, is it called the Litvinov grin that the Kray twins gave to some people, like.
I don't know. Makes me think of the Black Dahlia.
Right, well, they were definitely down the same dark alley, but I think it was, yeah, the Litvinov grin, because one of the Kray twins cut Litvinov
That was his trademark.
and get Chelsea grin. It's called the Chelsea grin. That was it. It was a thing that the Krays and presumably other people would do to, snitches or whatever, people who betrayed them, leaving obvious marks, so you would know, oh, that guy fucked with the Kray twins because he's got a Chelsea grin. So that, I mean, that would be close to, a genuine social phenomenon that corresponds with the Joker's grin, that doesn't require a vat of toxic waste. As I say, that was bridging between the comic book version origin and this latest one, which is, well, nothing really. I mean, at the end, he just uses blood to make the smile. So there's no indication that he's ever actually going to be disfigured.
Well, his trauma's on the inside. He suffered a brain injury, probably as the result of his mom's neglect. This is
Interesting.
all, this is all unreliable. We don't know, right?
The brain injury is in the Tell Me Who I Am documentary as well. The twin has amnesia because of brain injury, total amnesia, except he remembers his twin. That's the only thing he remembers. So then his twin has to fill him in on his whole past, and his twin makes up a happy past to conceal the true past. Anyway, it's an amazing story, and it'll make a very interesting fictional movie as well. But where were we with the Joker? Oh, the abuse. So they gave him a brain injury as if psychological trauma wouldn't be enough for modern audiences, right?
I see.
I hadn't thought about that, but it's probably true. They want him to be more fucked up than just somebody who's been horribly abused as a child, so they throw a brain injury in there too. Anyway, your point was it's an internal, and then it's rippling out onto the outside through this body dysmorphia. I don't know if we quite say he has body dysmorphia, but dysphoria. Those are two different things, dysmorphia and dysphoria. But anyway, he certainly alters his physical appearance in extreme ways so that his condition will show on the outside. He wears his madness on his sleeve.
So what you were, I feel like you were going somewhere with the body modification rituals that are part of, they're not taboo, right? Because
Well, they're not taboo. I mean, they are taboo, but they're the kind of taboo that signifies progressive behavior. Because progressive behavior, just like revolutionary action, always involves a degree of taboo breaking. Because otherwise, how are you progressing? What is progression if not going against previous social, standards and values? Gay marriage is considered progressive and right and tolerant and good and all the rest of it, but there are still millions, probably, of Christians today who consider it a sin. It's a taboo. Taboo that shouldn't ever be broken. So that tension is obviously very dynamic. I think it must be becoming more and more dynamic in our world because progressivism or progression or whatever has accelerated. So we've progressed ideologically and socially and morally and all the rest of it very rapidly in the past 100 years or less, 50 years, whatever it is, since the 60s, really, we're talking about, aren't we? 60 years. And that, of course, causes destabilization because things are constantly changing. It's liminality. And I think body, changing your body, which is, as I say, taboo, or it relates to taboo, it seems as though it's a way to try and reduce the anxiety of liminality by changing yourself to match it. You're trying to embody the trickster more. Trickster is always changing, but it would perpetuate, it would increase it because the more people could changing what they look like, the more weird society gets, and it's the uncanny valley. We don't know what we're
What we're looking
dealing
at.
with, what we're looking at.
Whistles. through my parts. The storm has come to us here, and welcome it to our hearts. See the bellowing trees on a wet and nasty day. It brings you to your knees. You know it won't go away. Air, more and more air. Wind whistles through my parts. The storm has come to us here, and welcome it to our hearts. Life is a journey. Straight but must bend, journey to the end in you. Air, more and more air. Wind whistles through my parts. The storm has come to us here, and welcome it to our hearts. Life is a journey. Search for our way through a sky without light.
I talked about body modification a little bit in Uncanny Valley. What did I was talking about how my sense is that it's all like a way to reconnect to these sort of primitive rituals, right? Like these kind of coming of age rituals that is generally when people get their piercings and tattoos. When they're teenagers, they get the things that the tattoo they're going to regret for the rest of their life.
Yeah, that's liminality, that transition between child and adult.
So, you know, this is my identity and I've made it definite because here's this permanent alteration of my body, and it's connecting to, you know, primitive cultural, you know, things that we don't have in our sort of Western secular. Although, you know, where does circumcision fit into this whole, you know?
Yeah, well, that's not a choice that anyone, well, I suppose it is sometimes, but as a tradition, it's nothing to do with choice. It's imposed on the infant. So that's something else. I mean, that's to identify individuals as part of a tribe, so that tribe maintains its collective identity. We could get into the Jews now if we're not careful. You could say that the Jews, there is something about the Jews, they've got a unified identity, collective identity, unequaled by any other people on the planet at this point, probably, even though they're not obviously, they wouldn't necessarily obviously recognize one another the way that black people would say.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have to whip down their pants. but I mean, it's got to be deeper than that, because we're not just talking about a social covenant. That's the point. It's a religious covenant. It's a spiritual covenant. But anyway, so you got people born into the global village, coming of age, who's my tribe? Well, you've got to find it. How do you find it? Well, I'm going to tattoo, UFO freak on my head, or the X-Files, or, well, there's so many examples that my brain just froze, but, you know, you could, whatever it is, you get the colors, you get your colors. You know, if you get piercings, then you recognize the other people with piercings, obviously, and you bond.
Right. It's mostly for young people in Western secular culture, it has to do with music. What do we identify with more than our musical tastes? And then there's all these shorthand visual cues that can be communicated. Oh, you're a punk rocker. I'm a punk rocker.
Yeah, with clothing, obviously. Clothing and hair. So piercing is the next level because you're showing, and tattoos, you're showing a level of commitment that transcends time. I mean, as in it's permanent. This is it. This is how committed I am to, you know, whatever it is. If you tattoo the Pixies on your arm, then it still is a band. But if it's a piercing, then it's not. It's culturally more wider, you know. It goes back further and it extends over different cultures and tastes, but it still transmits something. I mean, that you're willing to mutilate your body to disidentify yourself with the mainstream culture and align yourself with a more marginal culture, thereby securing a kind of tribal belonging.
I think it's not just about identifying with a marginal culture. I mean, that would be like the conscious aspect of it, but I also feel like it has to be this deeper thing about wanting to connect to something primitive and, you know, more eternal, really, than whatever this fucking bullshit culture you were born into, you know.
So, but then how much of these people, although they're trying to disidentify from the dominant culture, they're taking their signifiers from the culture itself. So, and that's obviously true of, you know, what movies you like or what bands you like. It's all being provided to you by the culture. It's true of transgender as well. Like, most of that isn't coming internally. It's coming from external stimuli that are basically saying, you know, buy this identity and you'll be happy.
There's so many socially acceptable forms of rebellion. I mean, in Portland, Oregon, it would be more transgressive to not have tattoos. You know? Like, people want a sense of continuity and a sense of permanence in this rapidly changing techno-secular culture. You know, people want the tattoos on their body to tell them, to tell their story, right? They want to tell the story of their life and have some sense of permanence, right?
So this is, I mean, this is how it converges ominously with the techno-utopian Burning Man ethic or aesthetic,
right?
There'll be plenty of people at Burning Man with tattoos and piercings, but also with Google glasses and even implants.
Yeah.
And if you get an implant, you've got a chip, you've actually literally got your data written on your body or into your body.
Mm-hmm.
So you're splicing yourself with the data bank of humanity. The global electronic global village is in you, as well as you being in it.
Right.
So that's very non-primitive. That's the opposite of primitive.
Right, but you would need... That's how I feel that that's how transhumanism works. Like, you know, like Christianity had to map its holidays onto existing pagan ones, you know.
So you're coattailing, or you're riding on the back of an ancient
tradition, right?
and desire or orientation, which is to be merged with the eternal.
Right. Right.
Which
and this one is just quite literal.
Well, except it's not eternal. Well, the transhumanists will tell you it is.
That's what I mean.
I forgot what I was going to hear with that. Oh, yeah. With, so Yeah, because, and this is traditional theology, is in order to merge with God, become one with God, you first have to go via Christ, and Christ is his bride is humanity. So to marry Christ, you first have to be integrated into the collective body of humanity. And then as humanity, you're the bride of Christ, and in marriage with Christ, you become one with God. So in order to return to or merge with the eternal, you first have to find your place within the human collective. So,
That sounds like a daunting task.
well, it certainly does if you try and do it through Twitter. I mean, if you're trying to do it through physical means, that's the thing about the internet, isn't it? Is it offers this illusion that this is non-physical somehow, that it transcends the physical, but of course it doesn't. It's just a more rarefied or, reduced version of the physical. It's more subtle and refined, but it's just as much physical as a rock or a hunk of lead. Even the cloud is just as much physical, right? It's just it's you know the atoms are distributed differently, but the whole transhumanist thing is physical. It's that's the whole that's the crux of it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a scientistic religion. It wouldn't. You can only claim that something is truly scientific, even if it isn't. If it's got a physical basis to it, because you've got to be able to count it, measure it.
Right, but it has a physicality without having a image to go along with it. Like if you say the word internet, there's not
It's
what
not an
picture draw
object.
that.
It's a
Yeah.
hyper object, isn't it?
Right, so it has that abstract kind of layer to it. It's
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I said a bit like R.C. Clarke, anything that was sufficiently advanced technology would be indistinguishable to us from magic. Anything that's sufficiently unimaginably large is indistinguishable to us from the infinite.
heaven, yeah,
Right?
right.
And now they're talking about, apparently they've got, they're talking about, the Internet of Things. So that's about microchipping everything that exists, including human beings, but taking it to a nanotechnological level, so they don't have to implant microchips. They have other ways or means to tag objects, yeah? And that they've created a data bank, or whatever the correct term would be, a resource, so that theoretically every grain of sand on the planet can have its own IP address, can be tagged,
Right.
right? So then, of course, it's all measured. It's all being measured by the machine.
All documented.
Yeah, tracked and documented. Every grain of sand. I mean, I don't know how literally they're planning to do this, and how theoretically or actually possible it is. I have no idea. But just the fact that it's a real goal, and that at least in terms of data space, it's possible. Like, it's a virtual infinite, as in there's no foreseeable end to the counting and the measuring and the mapping of the creation. I think this the prevailing theme here, and with Back to the Joker, is liminality, like town of chaos, and what it takes to maintain order or reintroduce order in the chaos. When the more aware we become of, more connected, the more aware we become of how connected we are, the more aware we become of each other, the more chaotic things begin to seem. right? Because if you just live alone and manage your garden and never see anyone, it's pretty easy to maintain order in your life. If you're Donald Trump and you're tweeting every day to millions of people, and vice versa, you're constantly negotiating. So it's a subjective feeling, how much chaos we can handle psychologically. But certainly we're constantly being tested via the internet, especially in terms of we're having to extend our, tolerance threshold for containing an awareness of things we can't control. So what's the solution? You exercise maximum control over your own body, number one. You might even become a tyrant for your own body. Number two, you try and turn yourself into somebody who has maximum control over other human beings.
Oof.
So that's the supervillain dyad, isn't it? That's what they all do. And that's what the SJWs and the trans and all that's what they're doing too. That thing about my body is my own, or what I do to my body is, that's the Satanic Temple as well. They have that credo. That's one of their seven tenets, that I can do anything I want to my body and nobody can say otherwise.
They're very anti corporal punishment.
Well, and they're also very pro, I imagine, bestiality and pedophilia. And I mean, they're going to have to bring in the thing about consent at some point. But obviously, consent is a blurry line as well. But anyway, as in, they do things with their body to gratify themselves. That's all allowed, provided it's not hurting anyone else. I mean, I'm assuming they would put that in because, as I say, they're trying to be virtuous. They're trying to appear like they're highly virtuous. All that I consider, feel confident about saying about the new Satanist and even the old Anton LaVey kind is the self-indulgence and self-worship. But it's not evil and it doesn't hurt anyone, which, of course, is a very questionable proposition in and of itself. Like, if I were to go around worshipping and indulging myself, I'm pretty sure
Somebody's going to get hurt along the way.
is the Phil Snyder thesis. He's the psychopath who wants to be the hero and who ends up the clown. It's exactly the great American psychopath thesis or model. Like his pathology is inseparable from his desire to be a somebody, to be a hero. And so all he can turn himself into is a clown because he gets everything wrong. Except he actually is a clown. And as you say, he's quite a good clown, but he wants to be more than a clown. So he brings a gun to the children's show. So he gets fired as a clown. So again, you've got the self that wants to be a hero, but is really a psychopath, thereby ends up acting like a clown. But a clown that believes he's the hero because he's a psychopath. See what I mean? Like the clown can't know he's a clown. The psychopath can't know he's a clown. If he starts to see it, then he really sees he's not a hero. The opposite of a hero, really. I guess say a hero has two opposites. One is the psychopath or the villain, and the other is the clown, the fool, the idiot. Well, I think that's the potential. I didn't feel like the movie was setting itself up for sequels, but it was opening a can of worms, I think. And the potential there was for the reverse of the dyad. So that in fact we've got it all wrong. The Batman, son of Thomas Wayne, vigilante arm of the police state, is the villain. The Joker, the suffering, lonely, alienated, child abused incel, who inspires a movement to take out the 1%, and restore justice to an unjust world through violence, admittedly, is the hero.
Mm-hmm.
As in, there's probably a lot of people who saw the Joker, well, as did I really, and felt exalted at the end, like, yeah, bring it on, let it come down, who want the world to burn.
Right.
And so they will, so someone like the Joker becomes ipso facto a force of good, or a desirable presence, in that he's sparking the apocalypse. He's lighting a match to the global village.
Right. Unintentionally.
I think it would have to be unintentional, wouldn't it? As I say, sure. The real hero is, we don't recognize him, number one, and number two, he doesn't know he's a hero.
He doesn't even know it. He doesn't even see it.
So that actually brings the whole thing full circle, because Joker's a psychopath who wants to be a hero, turns out as a clown. He accepts in the end he's not a hero, his life's not a tragedy, he's just a clown, it's a comedy. And only then does he become a hero, in quotes, as in an embodiment of the zeitgeist.
Mm. So he does see himself as a clown.
He definitely sees himself as a clown, yeah.
And then...
he embraces it.
Changes in the heart, change with the times. Strangers in the...
That's the end of this week's podcast.
For Gib Strange's latest Notes from Uncanny Valley podcast, click on the link in the show notes. I've got a bunch of new songs now, thanks to my wife's hunting and gathering skills. With bands like Emerald Park, Cotton Jones, Shorthand, Griefbirds, Entertainment for the Brain Dead, as a new injection of unheard songs to keep us entertained. Next week's podcast is with Sam Hyde, and we're talking about Dark Hollywood and George Hodel, Black Dahlia, Killing Charles Manson, avant-garde ritual, sacrifice and theatre of cruelty and things of that kind. I'm going to be having a Zoom meetup, I think, at some point pretty soon, the next few weeks leading up to Christmas. So if you're interested in attending that event, send me a line by email, jason@protonmail.com, or you can use the consult contact form at the website. If you want to support me and what I'm doing, you can do that by making a donation via PayPal at the website, and or buying my recent books and or reviewing them online. This is Jason Horsley, between the podcast, The Limitless.
Changes in the stars, change with the night. Strangers in the heart, stay up until light. Dangers in your soul.